You're tuning in to the Bookmatic's Best Book Podcast, where you will discover author secrets from books that'll make you feel, grow, and learn. These authors are from all over the world, all different backgrounds, and you are sure to learn a whole lot from their personal experiences. So please enjoy, subscribe, and let's get into it. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Bookmatic Best Books Podcast. I've got Nate Klemp here, and missing from the picture here is Kaylee Klemp, his wife. And he recently, or within the past year, wrote a book called The 80-80 Marriage. And I just finished reading it a few days ago or a week ago, and I really loved it. I thought that this topic about marriage is such an important topic. So welcome to the podcast, Nate.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Yeah. So like I said just a second ago, I think marriage is such an important topic. And so that's the reason why we got Nate on the podcast today. So Nate, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how and why you and your wife decided to write this book at this stage in your life?
Absolutely. Well, I am originally trained as a philosopher. So I got my PhD in philosophy. I was a professor for about 4 years. For the last 15 years, I've been really interested in two topics. One is mindfulness, and the other is relationships. So I sort of write about both areas. And in terms of relationships and marriage, our interest in this was really born of our own experience. So my wife, Kaylee, and I, we met when we were 17 years old. We were at high school. This is now over 25 years ago. We were chemistry lab partners. And the start to our relationship was almost this fairy tale, Instagram worthy story where we dated a little bit at 17, knew we were too young, got back together at 24, soulmates, got married. And then about a year into our marriage, everything totally changed. I had a serious bike accident. I was experiencing anxiety and depression for the first time. All of a sudden, the honeymoon phase was over. We were fighting all the time. We got very close to the edge of divorce. And so for the next 15 or so years, we really wanted to use our relationship almost as a laboratory to figure out what was it that was going on for us? What's going on for so many couples that reach a point like that? And how can we create a new model for relationships that's more compatible with the demands of modern life and the changing values? And I'll just say one more thing there. I think this is important because we are really the first generation in all of human history that's striving toward egalitarian marriages. You know, you think about the model of marriage that your parents had or your grandparents had, it's likely really different from your own. So that's why I think it's a really important time for us all to be thinking, like, how can we create a more intentional model for our relationship, given that the models we inherited that are sort of baked into our DNA often aren't really serving us?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely. So like you mentioned these models, you mentioned that you created a model. So can you tell us a little bit about the title of the book, The 80-80
Sure. Marriage,
this model right here?
Yeah, the title of the book is The 80-80 Marriage. And the basic model that we are arguing for in the book is called 80-80. And to have that make any sense, I probably need to talk about some of the other models that are like the foil or the contrast to that model. So let's maybe start with the 1950s. We call this the 80-20 model of relationship. That's a model where one partner, typically the woman, is responsible for 80% not only of the work around the household, but also of the emotional labor required to sustain the relationship. And we all know that that model for most couples has sort of fallen out of favor. And you know, we've had this revolution in gender norms that's amazing for all sorts of reasons. And so in place of that model, the center of gravity for modern relationships, we think, is what we call the 50-50 model of relationship. So this is basically the idea like, hey, we want to be equals and in love. This whole idea of inegalitarian marriage, we're no longer into that. So the way most couples, certainly we solved this problem early on, the default pattern, if you want to put it that way, is to say, okay, if we just make everything perfectly 50-50 fair, and not only that, if we keep a mental ledger of all of my amazing contributions juxtaposed against my partner's contributions, then somehow we're going to reach this point of perfect equality and fairness. We're going to ascend to the heavens of marital bliss and everything is going to be amazing. The problem with that model, as anybody who's ever tried it knows, is that it's like a mirage in the desert. You know, you see it off in the distance, but we never actually get there. We never ascend to the heavens of marital bliss. And in fact, the more we aspire toward fairness, the more we keep score, the more we create this feedback loop of tension and resentment and conflict. So I want to put those out there because our model that we're arguing for in the book is really saying like, hey, it's a great thing. I think we can all agree that we've shifted toward this 50-50 model. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with fairness. It's a noble ideal. That's a great thing. But we can go one step further where the goal is to sustain that spirit of equality, but also to create the conditions for love and generosity and all the things we most want out of marriage. And so the idea behind the 80-80 marriage is, what if we completely uproot this expectation of just 50% contribution, and instead we aspire toward something more like 80%, which makes no sense. The math doesn't work. We know this, but there's something really amazing and powerful that does happen when we make this shift. We think it's a shift from the mindset of fairness to the mindset of radical generosity. So I know that's a long-winded answer, but that's the three models we see as defining modern relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I really like this idea because, like you said, the math doesn't really work out. You have 80 plus 80 is 160, right? And you can't possibly go over that 100%. But after you read through your book, after I read through your book, the model made sense to me. And you also have to have time for yourself too. So that 20% is left over for you know, time for your hobbies or interests or whatever. I really like that aspect and I like how you explain it. And it makes, you know, makes some complete sense. Why not 100-100 though?
Yeah.
Let's get into that.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
So yeah, you might say, well, if you want to be really radical with your generosity and you want to really push beyond this cultural center of gravity of 50-50, then put in 100%. And the reason we don't think that's a very attractive model is that while it's certainly possible that you can underdo generosity, and I think as a culture, in terms of our relationships, we are guilty of that, you can also overdo generosity. So there's a risk of going too far. And 100% is basically this idea that you're giving up all of your individual projects, preferences, etc., to take on this radical version of generosity. And this is another trap, we think. You know, there are a lot of relationships where one person will become so generous that they become almost like the martyr of the couple. And they lose their voice, they lose their preferences, they lose their individuality. Mm-hmm. So we don't think that's very desirable either. And that's why 80%, and again, these numbers are, this is not meant to be some sort of like exact science, right? But the idea is we're trying to overshoot this place of fairness, this place of, hey, I'm only going to do my 50% fair share. But that's why we don't want to go too far with our generosity, because it can end up leaving us without these things that are really important to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just a little side note here, a little kind of
tip. Nice.
But the thing that initially drew my interest to your book was the title, of course, the 80-80. You got the big 80s in the middle of the book there. And of course, I've read the famous book, the 80-20, what is it called? 80-20 Principle?
Yes. Yeah. Right, of management science. Yeah. Management
science. Yeah, yeah. So it caught my interest because I had read that book before. And can we apply this to like marriage and like just the whole topic and the idea, and you know, you creating your own model was very interesting and helpful. So yeah. You mentioned I think one of your favorite words to use in the book is radical generosity and like changing your mindset. So how can someone struggling through maybe a rough point in their marriage start to shift towards that radical generosity and help their marriage to become better?
Yeah. Well, let's start with mindset. So this is a really important term for us. We think of mindset as essentially like the glasses you wear in your relationship. This is the lens through which you view the world in your relationship. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that's worth noting about mindset that I think is fundamentally important, especially for our model, is that both in relationships and in all of life, your mindset is contagious. So what I mean by that is the world and your partner have a way of mirroring back to you your mindset. What that means is that if you approach your partner with a mindset of fairness and resentment, your partner will, with 100% certainty, mirror that back to you at every single turn. Mm-hmm. And so that's an important principle, because what that means is if we're living in that 50-50 world of resentment and fairness all the time, and that's our mindset, it has this kind of like self-sustaining effect. It's a feedback loop with no way out. Mm-hmm. The other reason that's important is that if we're willing to shift our own individual mindset, even if our partner doesn't do anything, right? Our partner doesn't read the book. Our partner doesn't care about the book. Even if our partner doesn't even know that we're doing this, that shift in mindset from fairness to radical generosity also has a kind of contagious quality. So if I'm able to shift to a more kind of generous perspective where I see my partner's strengths instead of constantly seeing their weaknesses, if I shift from criticism to appreciation, all of these things are going to subtly change the underlying fabric of the relationship. And it's subtle, but it has these profound implications. So I always just like to point that out is like, you know, one of the critiques we often get is, or one of the worries, I guess I should say, that we often get is like, hey, you know, if I make this shift to radical generosity, then I've just become the doormat in my relationship. You know, my partner is not going to do it. They're going to take advantage of me. You know, nothing's going to change. And it's actually not true at all. Everything can change simply with your own shift in mindset. So the other part of your question, though, that I do want to just touch on briefly is like, okay, so if you want to make that shift, what are a couple of simple things you can do? In the book and in our work, we talk about a few pretty basic tools that you can apply here. One is contribution. So small acts of contribution go a long way to building this momentum of radical generosity. We're not talking about like huge things, you know, planning a trip to Fiji with your partner. That might be nice and you could maybe do that, but it's like getting them a coffee when you're out, filling up their car with gas, right? Like putting a sticky note on their computer that says, I love you. These small acts build the kind of underlying fabric of relationship. And then the other one I would just say is fundamentally important, I think maybe the most important, is appreciation. Mm-hmm. So most of us in our relationships, we fall into this pattern of criticism, complaint when it comes to our partner. We're sort of viewing them through the glasses of what they did wrong. Appreciation is a shift where we begin to see what our partner is actually doing right. And when we see that, we appreciate them. Hey, thank you for taking our kid to school today, or thank you for helping them with their homework, or, you know, all the work you did on the kitchen, whatever it is. They sound subtle, but you're sort of like rebuilding the connective tissue of your relationship by bringing these habits into your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like you were saying, maybe your partner doesn't even know that you're, you know, reading through this book and going through the exercises and kind of experimenting with it. And but they will naturally catch on to that, the changes in the way that you're treating them. I would say maybe you could just, after they start to catch on to that, you can introduce them to the book, right? Like, yeah, hey, you know, this is what I've been experimenting with for the past month or two. And then like, I read this book and I've been kind of following it. Maybe we can work on it together.
Yeah, I love that. It's kind of the stealth or the clandestine approach where you start by just making the shift yourself and then see what happens. I think, as you said, the most powerful way to begin implementing habits like this is to eventually do it together as a team and both have this awareness of like, hey, this is what we're working toward. But I love the idea of starting with that more individual approach and just see what happens, you know, see if it's another principle, like, you know, is it true for you that your partner mirrors back your mindset? That's a fun experiment to run.
Yeah, definitely. And so if you were doing these experiments, let's say, and then you have a partner that's not really going along with it, or not like reacting, and maybe still being quite selfish. I think it's what you called a reluctant partner or something like that, right?
In the book.
So
that's right.
What would you do in this type of scenario where the partner is not making any sort of changes based on your actions?
Yeah. And this is a really common dynamic in relationships. This was our dynamic in my relationship. I was the reluctant partner. And one way to think of this is in a lot of relationships, just through historical accident, because of outdated gender norms, one partner is what we might think of as the over-contributor. They do more, they try harder, they're more invested in a way. And the other partner is what you might think of as the under-contributor or the reluctant partner. And so this is a kind of classic modern dynamic. It's often gendered, where the woman in a heterosexual relationship is the over-contributor, but it doesn't have to be. You know, we've in our interviews that we did for the book, we interviewed about 100 people for the book. We found that it can be the reverse. It can also show up in same-sex marriages, right? So it's a kind of classic archetypal dynamic. Mm-hmm. And to your point, what's tricky about this dynamic is that there's no clear way out of this. And the way in which most over-contributing partners try to get out of the dynamic is through that mindset of fairness, right? They feel a lot of resentment toward their partner. They complain a lot. They nag their partner. They tell their partner, you're not doing enough. And what's really interesting and paradoxical is that the more they lean into trying to make things fair, the over-contributing partner, the more the under-contributing or reluctant partner just basically pulls away. Mm. And, you know, in the context of our marriage, it was me saying, nothing I do will ever be good enough, so I'm just going to stop doing anything at all, right? It's just, and so paradoxically, by trying to make things more fair in this dynamic, you actually make things less fair, more unequal. Mm-hmm. And so that's obviously not going to work. So the question becomes, okay, well, how can we use some of these tools of the 80-80 model to unwind this dynamic? I think there are a couple things that couples can do to work on this. So one is this idea of shifting your own mindset. As I talked about before, mindset is contagious. That can be really powerful. But to your point, that might not be working. Your partner might not even notice. That's certainly possible. So there are a couple other pieces that could be useful. One is to have a conversation where the over-contributing partner just reveals their what's going on for them. And so this is it's a nuanced conversation. What you don't want to do here is just, you know, throw out a litany of complaints. That's the habitual way of doing it. But it's more revealing, like, hey, I notice that when I'm doing so much, I feel resentful toward you. And I don't want to feel that way. I want to be in love with you. I want us to thrive together. And so how can we think about changing some of our systems, changing our roles, things like that, to be in connection and to help me so I don't feel frustrated all the time? Right. So that's, we call that a reveal and request style conversation. Mm-hmm. And then the other piece that I think is really interesting and really challenging for over contributing partners is this idea of, is there like asking yourself the question, is there a way in which I am participating in this dynamic? Put differently, is there a way in which I am holding this dynamic in place through my own actions? And most over contributing partners, you know, would say like, no, like, why would I want this dynamic? This is terrible, right? I'm doing everything. But often there are subtle things that are happening, right? Like maybe they actually like having the control over everything in the house and all the logistics. Mm-hmm. And part of what's holding this dynamic in place is like not wanting to let go of that control. So sometimes there are ways in which we're actually holding this dynamic in place. And if we can go into the discomfort of letting that go, all of a sudden the dynamic changes pretty rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Like a self-reflective, like, hey, look at, try to take a step back, look at what you're doing, and then pull through those threads and figure out, hey, what can I do to make this situation better?
Right. Yeah. In the book, we run a process. We have a process for couples called the unconscious commitments process. And mm-hmm. it's basically looking at like, how am I unconsciously committed to a relationship where I do everything and my partner does nothing? And it's a really hard question again, because most people would be like, I'm not committed to this. I hate this. Right. But if you really take a step back and you get radically curious, often there are things that we are doing to hold these dynamics in place. And once you can become aware of those things, all of a sudden you can begin to unwind them. Mm-hmm. And that's how you get out of the pattern.
Definitely. So as we both know, marriage is such an important topic. I don't think enough married couples learn about it and read about it and try to work on it, which is one of the problems with, you know, divorce rates and stuff like that. So for those people who are maybe, this may be their first time considering about reading a marriage book. So how does reading a book like yours not just make a better marriage for themselves, but also help make the world around them better and make society better?
I love that question. First of all, I want to talk about the stigma around reading marriage books. I didn't know how deep that stigma was until we wrote a marriage book. And we would get these funny stories, like this friend of mine, she bought our book and her husband was looking at their Amazon cart and he was like, what's happening? Should I be worried? Why did you buy a marriage book? And I thought that was so illuminating, this idea that if you're reading a marriage book, that means you must be right on the verge of divorce.
Yeah, that's weird.
And it's weird because, like, think about the way we think about leadership books. If you see a leader of a company reading a book on how to be a better leader, you don't automatically assume, well, they must be the worst CEO in the history of corporations, right? Or if you see somebody reading a parenting book, you don't think, oh, you know, they must be so brutal and terrible with their children that they have to read a parenting book. And yet, you know, same with like exercise, right? Like people read a book on exercise or nutrition. We don't assume that they're like the world's worst eater. We assume, yeah, they realize the value of this thing and they want to get better. And so it's hilarious to me that when it comes to marriage, we somehow have this exception where we say, you know what? Relationships and marriage, they should be super easy. We should all have this figured out. And the only people who need to read about this are people who are just like terrible at their relationship. So I think that's like total crap. And it's just like, that's not true at all. Mm-hmm. I think relationships are just as, if not more complicated than anything else we're trying to do in life, leadership, mindfulness, et cetera. Exactly. So it can be really helpful to take a step back and think about like, how have we set this up? What are our patterns? How do we create new patterns that are better? So that's just to touch on the stigma piece. And then you also asked about, well, okay, like what are the benefits of this? And I think that's an important question because the reality is everybody's busy. We all have all sorts of stuff going on. You know, why put your time and energy into something like your relationship? I think there are a couple of answers. At the level of your relationship, the answer is, you know, just think about all the energy that's drained out of your life when you're arguing, when you're fighting, when you're resentful. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of life energy and creative energy. And imagine having all of that energy available to you. It's like profound.
Yeah.
But then the other piece to that is that I think there really is a ripple effect when it comes to the health of your relationship. And you can see this most clearly if you look at couples that are really dealing with toxic energy between them. That ripple effect goes down to their children, their friends, their relatives, their extended family, right? It influences the whole system. And when it comes to relationships that are thriving, the same ripple effect holds, but it's a different kind of influence. It's like, you know, a ripple of love and generosity and all these qualities that we want our kids to model, that we want, you know, our friends to see, our extended family, et cetera. So I like to think that the benefits can be pretty big, pretty all-encompassing to doing this kind of work.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. It's amazing the impact that we individually can make. And then, of course, as a couple, as a married couple, you can make a huge difference around you. And it just filters down the line. I like your example of that filtering from you to your kids, to your relatives, to your friends, and also coworkers too, right?
Yeah.
If you had a fight and then you go into work and then you argue with a colleague, it just ripples effect. And then if you're having a great marriage, it's the opposite, right?
Yeah.
Others with respect and positivity and
totally.
So
totally agree.
Definitely. Is there anything else that you would like to add to this conversation?
Well, there's one more thing I want to say about fairness, because I know for most couples, that's kind of the default habit. It's almost where we feel comfortable. And there's some research that really, when I read this research, it was the first time I thought, like, we should write a book about this. This could be a big idea. And basically the research is about cognitive biases. So these kind of biases in our thinking that make this argument over fairness impossible to ever resolve. And so I think it's useful to talk about those. So the first is what cognitive psychologists call availability bias. Mm-hmm. This is basically just the idea that if you think about any relationship, you know, in my relationship, as an example, all of the things that I do for my kids, for my wife, for our house, around logistics, planning, all of that information is available to me. I see it happening in real time. I know what's happening there. But when it comes to what my wife is doing, I only see a small fraction of what she does, right? Like, I'll see a few things here and there, but I don't actually know what she's doing much of the time. And so as a result, like, there's this tendency to systematically underestimate the contributions of your partner just because of this cognitive bias. And then on top of that, there's another cognitive bias, which we call the overestimation bias, where in time studies, they've basically shown that both women and men, but particularly men, overestimate the amount of time that they spend on household tasks and childcare. And it's specifically those two. We actually are pretty good at estimating the amount of time we spend on work and other things. But when it comes to childcare and household tasks, we're really bad at estimating what we've done. So the implication of that is like, so I say like, you know, it's not fair. I spent 90 minutes cleaning up the house yesterday. Well, it's likely there's an overestimation bias in play and it was more like 45 minutes or 60 minutes. So we have these cognitive biases. And if you think about the strategy of fairness, like here we are with these cognitive biases, we're underestimating what our partner does, we're overestimating what we do, and we're trying to achieve 50%. You can see how that's completely impossible, right? Because we're both subject to these cognitive biases. We're both basing our assessments of fairness on sheer delusion, essentially. And so it's no wonder why this strategy doesn't work. And it was really once I saw that research that I started to think, if we're ever going to get out of this, we have to move the bar from 50% to 60% or 70%. Because like, given these cognitive biases, the way to actually hit 50% is to try to contribute at 60% or, you know, 70%, right? Like it exposed to me the fundamental flaw in the way most of us think about our relationships and think about the role of fairness in them.
Yeah. Yeah. I see how, and I've also experienced something similar to where, hey, you do this and we do this and we schedule it all out. And it's like, oh, but you missed it and you didn't do it. And then you start blaming each other.
Yep.
It's like, yeah, it just doesn't work that way. It doesn't work perfectly. Maybe better than 80-20, but still. Yeah, it doesn't work. Yeah. It creates fights and stuff. So,
absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
I'm so happy that we had a chance to talk about your book and share it with the Bookmatic audience on YouTube, on podcast platforms, wherever you can listen to podcasts and everything. So thank you so much for coming on the show. I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Matt. And I would just say for anybody who's interested, you can find out more at 8080marriage.com. We also have a free newsletter that we send out once every couple of weeks with just kind of like tips and insights on how to have a better relationship. So you might check that out as well.
Mm-hmm. And what's the best social media to follow you on as well?
Probably Instagram, 8080 marriage. Sorry, yeah, Instagram handle.
Remember.
8080 marriage. Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect. All right, Nate, you take care of yourself. Everyone, thank you so much for listening. And don't forget to subscribe for upcoming episodes and get a copy of the 8080 Marriage.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Yeah, thank you.
You're tuning in to the Bookmatic's Best Book Podcast, where you will discover author secrets from books that'll make you feel, grow, and learn. These authors are from all over the world, all different backgrounds, and you are sure to learn a whole lot from their personal experiences. So please enjoy, subscribe, and let's get into it.